She told Kathy Lee Gifford what you felt like when you couldn't go to the bathroom and your body hurt because they limited it to once in the morning, once in the afternoon, and how humiliated you felt and how pain and what kind of pain it actually was. And she told Kathy Lee Gifford what it was like to come out of work at 9 o'clock at night in a pitch darkness in a poor area with no public transportation when you gather together with the other little kids and you run home together whistling and singing because you're afraid you're going to be raped or assaulted. And you hang out together and run home for protection. When she finished, Kathy Lee Gifford became a human being for 15 seconds and apologized to Wendy. It was a remarkable scene. She leaned over this Hollywood personality and she said, "Please believe me. I didn't know. I had no idea. And now that I know, I'm going to work with you. I'm going to work with these other people. I will never allow it to happen again." That night, we signed an agreement with Kathy Lee Gifford that she would never again tolerate sweatshops, that her factories around the world would be open to independent inspection by religious, labor rights, and human rights leaders to guarantee compliance with human rights and labor rights, and that workers around the world should be paid a living wage so they and their families could live in dignity. She signed that last part because I don't think she knew what it was, living wage. But, you know, I doubt many people here read The Enquirer. I did an interview with them. At first, I thought I was being interviewed by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Then the questions became weirder and weirder, and I realized this is a different newspaper. But anyway, they just put out a two-page story on Kathy Lee Gifford, which was really quite interesting. They compared the mansions that the Giffords have, a $5 million mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut, $1 million apartment in New York, $1 million Palm Beach thing in Florida, and Aspen, Colorado, with the homes of the workers in El Salvador that make the Kathy Lee pants. And they compared the lives of the children in Salvador, of the mothers making the clothing, with Cody and Cassidy, those two things that she's always talking about on television. Anyway, very interesting. They spend $36 a week on dog food, and the family in El Salvador is trying to live on these starvation wages. Well, at any rate, the meeting was ending, and Kathy Lee tried to make one last attempt to get us all to cry, and I knew it was coming because they're passing the Kleenexes out, and I got a few of them. And then Kathy Lee says to little Wendy, she says, Wendy, do you know how sad it was for me when my two little kids come to me and say to me, Mommy, why is everybody saying such bad things about you on television?" And she expected us all to burst into tears. Nobody cried, the Kleenexes were collected, and the meeting was over. But nothing really changed. Not long after that, we found these Kathy Lee pocketbooks made in China. The same hand tag, you buy this pocketbook, you're going to help the little kiddies. Well, they again leave out the fact that young women in China make the pocketbooks, forced to work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. They pay them 12 and a half cents an hour. So obviously that's $1.25 a day, $8.75 for the week. But they house in dormitories and they take out $5.41. That leaves them with $3.44 after a 70-hour work week making pocketbooks for Kathy Lee Gifford. And we're to believe that that exploitation in China is going to help little kiddies in the United States. It's incredible lies on the part of Walmart and Kathy Lee. These are the dormitories. 16 people will be stuffed into a room. Army bunk beds will be pushed up against each other. And in these thin bunk beds, there'll be two women on each level of the bunk bed. And they hang up cardboard and cloth for privacy. In the mornings, they're fed a thin rice gruel, and for lunch and supper, stir-fried vegetables. But don't think that Walmart and the other U.S. companies aren't human, because they are. When the workers work past midnight, the next day they get a special treat. They get the rice gruel and bread. So you got to hand it to them. It's not, there's parts of them that are human. It's not just Walmart either. It's more. This Teletubby I carry around, it's the Teletubby, of course, Jerry Falwell attacked viciously because said it was gay. Now, he's certainly off the wall, this guy. But there is a story behind the Teletubby. And that story is, of course, it, like all toys, was made in China. And the Teletubby is the largest selling toy in the United States. $1 billion the American people spent on the Teletubbies. $1 billion. It's made in China by young women 17 to 25 years of age. They work, it's a factory called Door Lock. They work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. They work from 7 o'clock in the morning until 1 o'clock at night. They're allowed 4 hours of sleep. They get a half a day off a month, which is payday. That's their break. They're paid 13 cents an hour. So for the 112-hour week, they get paid $14.42. But they take out $2.40 for dorm expenses, so it ends up leaving them with $12.02 for 112 hours of work. This Ellen Tracy garment, it's $155, made in China. The workers who made it got paid 23 cents an hour. You talk about the markup. 23 cents an hour, and they work from 7:30 in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. This lapel pin I carried around, can't get anybody interested in it. The media doesn't think it's a story. This lapel pin was made for the Republican National Committee. And they interviewed the owner of the company. He was like entrepreneur, small business entrepreneur of the year. And they asked him, how do you do it? You know, this stuff's very competitive. You gotta paint and you're hand polishing. Anyway, this guy made a mistake, and he told the truth to a small business magazine, which someone then sent me. He said, I'll tell you how I do it. They sold 250,000 of these to the Republicans. He said, I'll tell you how I do it to the Republican Party. I have a factory in China. I have 250 workers. I own them. That's a direct quote. They work from 7 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. They live 16 to a room. I pay them 9 cents an hour, and they're mostly little girls from the countryside. So little girls from the countryside work until 11 o'clock at night and paid 9 cents an hour are making these lapel pins, but that's not a story. No one's interested in it. If I could just tell one last story about Walmart, and then I'm going to finish. Walmart is a very patriotic company. Again, very interesting. If you go into the Walmarts, the flags and the banners and bring it home to the USA, made right here, proud of our neighbors who made these products, support American manufacturers that support American jobs. This intrigued me a lot because Walmart was actually saying, if that was true, that they wouldn't enter the race to the bottom, that they wouldn't chase 9-cent wages around the world, that there were standards below which they wouldn't go. Human rights standards, women rights standards, labor rights standards, wage standards below which they wouldn't go. So I called Walmart and I said, well, I'm interested in your Buy America policy. How many of your goods are actually made in the United States? And there was this stupid silence on the other side of the phone, and they said, we can't tell you. We don't know, they said, which, of course, is stupid. They have the largest private data bank in the world. They monitor every single product in the Walmarts. So I figured, once again, something's going on here. So we decided to go into Walmart and start counting clothing. And I wouldn't advise this to anybody. I spent an entire summer doing it. You'll lose a lot of gray matter. And when we first started, we went in to the stores with notebooks. And we were going around the store, and we would be counting. Oh, look at this. We were writing it down. Found out you couldn't write in Walmarts against the law. There are even hidden cameras. It looks out of control, but there are hidden cameras, and you're immediately escorted out of the store. You cannot write in a notebook in Walmart. Then we started taking photographs. And you couldn't do that either. It was worse than the Exmotica factory in El Salvador. They wanted the film, too. It was the same thing. Only they didn't have armed guards and they didn't beat us up or anything. But they would scream and yell. Taking pictures in Walmart makes us very nervous. Well, we found out that you could act pretty weird in Walmart and no one would say a single thing. So we discovered how to do our research. We used hidden tape recorders, voice-activated tape recorders. And I spent the entire summer in Walmart talking aloud to myself. And so I would go into Kathy Lee Gifford's clothing, and I go, oh, look at this, blouses from Indonesia, 1, 2, 32 blouses, $18. Oh, look at these dresses from Malaysia, 1, 2, 3. And we did this the entire summer. We'd leave on a Friday night, and we would go to a Walmart, count clothing for 2 or 3 hours, go to the hotel, transcribe the tapes. That was even more boring. Get in the car the next day, do 3 Walmarts on a Saturday, transcribe the tapes Saturday night, back to a Walmart Sunday morning, and start all over again. And one Sunday morning, I was in a Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in a supercenter where there are lots of flags and everything, and I was completely exhausted. And it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in the Kathy Lee section. I'm counting dresses and blouses. And now, admittedly, that looks pretty weird. What is this man doing 9 o'clock in the morning counting blouses in the women's section? And a mother was there with her 2 kids, and they're looking at me, and one of the kids started walking towards me, and the mother screams, stay away from that man. And she grabs him by the arm and yanks him away. And I felt like saying, lady, this is serious research, you know. One day they'll write about this stuff in the universities, you know. But I kept my mouth shut. That's the other danger of the work is my bag. I travel a lot, but it's filled with all the sweatshop clothing. I can only carry like 2 shirts for myself. But my bags are all full of women's clothing and toys. And when you go through these airports, especially internationally, I'm always nervous. They always check my thing for gunpowder and everything, because I look so nervous when I'm going through these detectors and everything. Well, this project with the tape recorders, we ended up counting 105,000 items in Walmart, 86,500 pieces of clothing, and 17% were made in the United States, 83% were made offshore. We counted 16,245 pairs of shoes, and only 16 shoes were made in the United States. Not 16%, 16 pairs of shoes, that was no doubt a mistake. 1,910 handbags and pocketbooks, zero, were made in the United States. Kathy Lee clothing, 11% in the United States, 89% offshore. Fate of Glory men's clothing, 13% in the U.S., 87% offshore. McKid's children's clothing, 4% in the U.S., 96% offshore. Walmart was flat out lying to the American people. So we thought about suing them. I figured they're always trying to sue us. We're going to turn around and sue Walmart for lying to the American people, false advertising. So we started to research their documents, and we found it. In black and white, Walmart had an unprecedented commitment to purchase American-made goods. And we clapped with joy until we saw the small print. Walmart has an unprecedented commitment to purchase American-made goods whenever they can meet the pricing available offshore. So if you find someone that works for 9 cents an hour in the United States, Walmart will buy your goods. So they had a loophole. But, this is how phony these companies are. And what they're about is really the race to the bottom. And I'll end with this. These two pair of jeans, I think, tell a story. They were hanging right next to each other in the department store. They're 100% the same. Britannia jeans, it's owned by the VF now, one of the most miserable apparel companies, a real sweatshop abuser. $17.99, both of them. One difference. One was made in the United States. The other was made in Nicaragua. In the United States, everything is by piece rate. A worker gets 15 minutes. Workers get 15 minutes to assemble a pair of pants. At $8.42 an hour, there's $2.08 of labor in this pants made in the United States. That's 11.5% of the retail price of the garment is in labor. That's typical. It's always like 10% in that area when a product's made in the United States. 10% of the cost is in labor. In this case, 11.5%. When they take the work out of the United States, all they do is translate the piece rate into the local currency. It sounds like rocket science, but it's not. If it's 100 pieces in the United States for $8.31 an hour, when they take the work offshore, it now becomes 100 pieces for 23 cents an hour. That's the great translation of the business people. Well, but they're not inhuman. This is a real science of exploitation. They look at the 23 cent an hour wages in Nicaragua and they say, wait a second. Those people, they're malnourished. Give them more time. Take 5% off the piece rate. Oh, wait a second. It's 100 degrees in the factory. They're exhausted. Take 5% more off the piece rate. Let's give these workers more time. Oh, they're working 12-hour shifts? Oh, that's hard. Let's give them a little bit more time. Take 5% off the piece rate again. So in Nicaragua, the U.S. companies give them a full 33% more time. They give them 20 minutes to make a pair of jeans. 20 minutes to make the jeans. In this pair of jeans, there's 14 cents of labor. They've taken the labor of $2.08, 11.5% of the garment, they've wiped it out to 14 cents, or 0.8% of the retail price of the garment. On every single pair of jeans they would take out of the United States, they'd save $1.93. In this factory in Nicaragua, there's 800 workers making 14,000 pairs of jeans, which means they save $27,000 a day, $162,000 a week, or $8.4 million for the year. That's one label in one factory, and companies like Walmart have 1,000 factories in China alone where there are multiple labels. And you begin to understand where their profits come from. And, of course, the workers' rights were denied. Under the World Trade Organization, under the system as it exists now, which they want to nail into place and extend, corporations want the American people to believe that misery and poverty around the world gives them a license to exploit people, which is a concept that we have to smash completely if we're ever to remake the economy with the human face. Companies right now are completely free to roam the world in search of misery. That's what they do, because you'll find the lowest wages there. Then they can take the American people or people anywhere in the world and pit them against each other in this race to the bottom. Who will accept the lowest wages, the least benefits, the most miserable living and working conditions just for the honor of having a job? There's not one single multinational company that will sit down at the table to discuss linking trade to human rights or worker rights, to women's rights, to environmental protections. Not one. They say that's an impediment on free trade. Well, I think what you're doing here in Seattle is, like was said earlier, one of the most important fights you can have. No country, no company should get an unfair trade advantage through hiring children, through firing pregnant women, through firing and blacklisting trade unionists, through paying starvation wages, through locked bathrooms. No company or country should get a competitive advantage on the basis of that repression. If China enters the World Trade Organization, it'll be an enormous step backwards for human rights. In China, if you try to meet to discuss factory conditions, you're fired and thrown out, if you're even seen discussing factory conditions. If you form an independent union in China, you're going to be put into a psychiatric ward, or you're going to be put into hard labor for 3 years under administrative detention without a trial. And the same goes for religious organizations or women's organizations or human rights organizations. When we were in China, there was a strike. And the way the strikes take place in China is the workers just stop working. They can't have a banner. They can't talk. They can't shout. No slogans. They just stop working. And the military and the police show up, and they throw barricades up around the factory so the disease doesn't spread. Then they go in, and they interview the workers one by one. And when they think they pinpointed the organizers, they, of course, get fired and thrown out. The rest of the workers are fined, and they go back to work. It's a frightening place. I was completely blown away. Motorola has invested $1.2 billion in China. You go past the GM plant, and you drive past it for about 10 minutes outside of Shanghai. 10 years ago, it was rice paddies. Now there is a General Motors plant is as big as you can't even imagine it. And Shaw plants, one after another, after another, after another, making all the microwave ovens. And the disparity in wealth in China now is greater than it is in the United States. The top 20% of the people control 55.3% of the wealth. Their Mercedes-Benz is everywhere. The bureaucrats are doing just great. They go around in big, sleek, black Mercedes-Benzes. The one-child policy doesn't apply, one-child per family doesn't apply to the bureaucrats. You go to a hotel, $120 a night, and these people are in there with five and six kids, putting them each in an individual room. There's an enormous amount of money there, and yet the workers have nothing. They're paid the 12.5 cents, the 28 cents. The workers have bicycles, and the bureaucrats have limousines. Frightening. No freedoms whatsoever. Well, I'm going to end on a good note. This T-shirt was made in El Salvador. It's a Yale T-shirt. And we tracked the workers down who made it. You know, tuition at Yale is $30,000 a year, room and board. The shirt's $14.99. The women were paid 3 cents to make this shirt in El Salvador. And what's happening across the country, and by the way, there's about $1.37 of material in the garment, so you figure out the markup and everything. What's happening across the country with the students, and if there are students here, your movement is the most important human and labor rights movement we have today. The other day, if you saw in the Wall Street Journal, they attacked us and they attacked the students. And the thing that the Wall Street Journal was angry about the most, it was the lead editorial last Friday, was the fact that the students were opposing the World Trade Organization. That made the Wall Street Journal go livid. They went completely nuts. If you haven't seen it, I have a copy. We'll send it to people. The White House is calling United Students Against Sweatshops and asking for meetings. I mean, it is amazing power that you've got right now. The companies don't know how to deal with you. The administration doesn't know how to deal with you. The biggest nightmare a company has, a multinational, is when young people ask serious questions. Where did these garments come from? Who made them? How old were they? Was it a living wage? What conditions did they live under? The minute you start challenging these companies, they wet their pants. They can't take it. You know, they got a whole public relations thing geared up against the unions. And I've watched this for years. If a union comes and says, this company's using child labor, this company's violating the rights of the workers, the company says to the media, oh, come on, what do you think that union's going to do? They're paid to attack us. That's their job. Congratulations. That's their job. If they didn't attack us, they'd be fired. And besides, you can't believe a thing they say, because they're antagonists in the story, we'll grant you that, but you can't believe them. And they get away with that. The $650 million advertising budget for Nike goes a long way. Well, when students come and ask those same questions, the whole public relations propaganda machinery of the companies collapses and falls to the knees, and they're completely panic-stricken. Right now, the students, in my mind, are in the driver's seat of this entire movement. And it's an enormous opening that you have, but it also comes with enormous responsibility. And just finally, when we did this last Kathy Lee story, they try to crash our press conferences to upset them. So we did a press conference in New York and one in Washington. In the Washington press conference, we're on the plane leaving New York, the shuttle to go to Washington, and I'm sitting there and I look up, I'm writing notes, and I look up, and down the aisle is coming this guy, Robert Adler, who actually makes the Kathy Lee Gifford label. And behind him is Frank Gifford, Kathy Lee's husband. And I think to myself, oh crap, you know, gonna be a confrontation on the plane. I don't need this at 7 o'clock in the morning. I say to the Salvadoran women and the union organizer, I say, just keep your heads down, work on the notes, don't look up, and don't leave the plane. We'll be the last to leave. So, sure enough, we land in Washington, and we let the whole plane empty out, and I stand up to grab my bag, and who else stayed in the plane but Robert Adler and Frank Gifford, like it was high noon or something. And he comes over to me, Frank Gifford, and he says, puts his face in my face, and he says, I just want you to know that I'm following you around and I'm going to be in your face when you're telling all these lies about my wife. And he was huffing and puffing, trying to be intimidating. And I said to him, have a nice day. And he went outside. He got in line for a cab. And we had to get a cab. We went outside. He's glaring at us. Well, we go to the press conference. And, of course, he crashes into the press conference. And we give him the chance to speak. And he walks up to the microphone. And he comes behind me. And he was trying to elbow me in the back and everything. And he starts crying. Too. I mean, this is incredible. And he starts saying, how dare you attack my Kathy? How dare you? She does more for workers around the world than all of you put together. And for children around the world. What about the children? So when he gets done, and he's pointing at me and everything, I say, well, what about the 13-year-old kids in Honduras? You know, what about the 12.5-cent wages in China? You know, what about the hundreds of thousands of young women locked behind barbed wire and working under armed guards who return to hovels, one-room hovels, and raise their kids on coffee because they can't afford food? What about them? You know, they have a problem. I would say that Frank Gifford and Kathy Lee and their two little kids are the less intellectual side of the World Trade Organization. But they believe that the world revolves around them. Well, they have it a little wrong. It doesn't revolve around them. There are human beings in this world, these hundreds of thousands of young women locked in these factories, and that's where the focus belongs. And I think that's what you're doing here. We can have multiple strategies to go after the World Trade Organization, but one of the key approaches is don't let them take the focus off of where it belongs, and it belongs on the human face, behind that label, behind the product, the exploitation, the starvation wages, the armed guards. That's where the focus belongs, not with Mad Mike yesterday. But one last thing. At this press conference, I'm listening to this guy Adler, who makes the Kathy Lee label. He stands up and he says that Kathy Lee is the Joan of Arc of sweatshops, like I mentioned earlier. And I'm asking him questions, and he tells me, well, the pregnancy testing, oh, that's a cultural issue. We can't do anything about it. Pregnancy testing is a cultural issue for El Salvador. Oh, the 60-cent wages, oh, $1.18 an hour? Oh, he says, I don't know anything about that. You'd have to be an economist. That's a big issue you're talking about. We don't know what you're talking about. Well, he's going on like that, and then Frank Gifford's crying and attacking us. And I was watching one of the students who was there with us, Eric Bracken, who's the head of United Students Against Sweatshops. Eric comes over to the podium, and as long as I've done the work, and of course we're fairly aggressive going after the companies, but by this time I expect the companies to talk like that. That's the baloney that they say. I expect it. I expected Frank Gifford to do that. I didn't expect anything different. Well, Eric and the students are not accepting. And they don't accept that, and they won't accept it. And Eric was standing at the podium, and he started to scream at Frank Gifford and Adler. Gifford left the room, and I was looking at this guy. He looked like a million-dollar bill, beautifully tanned, every hair in place, and he's sitting there like this. And as Eric started yelling at him, you know, not violently or anything, but passionately going after him, I watched his face go from one of, like, complete composure to nervousness. Then he got a little frightened. Then he looked completely confused, and he looked completely out of it. And I realize what's going on here is that there's a new element on the scene, and it's the students. Now, we can run good campaigns. We can do the good research. We can be out there on the streets. The new element is the decency and purity of the students that won't take lies or compromises for an answer. When Eric burst through there with the truth and with the dignity and the call for justice, this guy began to collapse, this Adler guy. And I think that if we, all of us, with the religious people, the labor people, and the students, if we keep going forward, there's no such thing as NAFTA written in stone. There's no such thing as the World Trade Organization written in stone. All of it can be demolished, just like Wendy did to Walmart.